Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show. We do it every Saturday starting at 2 o'clock. And not only do I love to share my guests, but I love to tell you what's going on. The Mostly Mozart Festival, which is quite spectacular if you've never been to any of the wonderful concerts and events. It's here. It's the 52nd annual summer celebration, and it's going to go through August 12th. Do it. MostlyMozartFestival.org. Or go to Geffen Hall or Alice Tully Hall box office, 212-721-6500. I love that. And, you know, I've traveled a lot, and I love going to any place in China. Some of my favorite events were going to the night markets. Well, you know, we have a Queen's Night Market Saturdays starting at 6 o'clock, going to midnight. And you are going to love it. We have a wonderful, entertaining show, and I'm so happy you're part of it. Straight ahead, the Joan Hamburg Show.
From food to fun and so much more, the Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
What's more fun than a gastronomic adventure, especially through the eyes and taste of someone else, meaning you can enjoy every bit of it and it's totally not fattening because you're only eating with your imagination and you're going to wonderful places in the world and you're going to share Susan Buckley's remarkable story. And it starts when Susan, who was an editor and probably beginning her adventures as a writer in her wee youth, meets a guy who was known for his appetites and known for his writing, and she ultimately starts to edit him from her publishing house. And what happens is now all clear in Eating with Peter. So, Susan, you had the kind of job that many of us after college a long time ago had. You worked for a publisher if you were interested in the arts or literary at all.
Exactly. And my very first job right out of college was at Holt Reinhardt and Winston, and I was an editorial secretary. And, of course, it took me a long time to realize that all of the boys were editorial assistants, which was one rank higher. But anyway, it was a wonderful place. It was very old-fashioned publishing at that point. And one of the people who was wandering around the school department, the educational publishing department, was this very large, tall, sort of alluring man. And we all knew that he had a backstory of being a friend of Ernest Hemingway's and knowing all about bullfights. And so I eventually got to know him. And then I was theoretically his editor, although he didn't let me edit anything. And then over many years, I knew him for 9 years before we were married.
That's so interesting. And you were still at this publisher?
No. I stayed there for the first 7 years.
Right. That's a lot.
Yeah. That was a long time. But it was an old-fashioned world at that point. You know, I said somebody was saying, well, you got out of college in 1963, but really I'm a child of the 50s. You know, I went to college in Vermont, and if you went to Berkeley, maybe it was the 60s, but at Middlebury it was the 50s.
And one of the great schools. So after you got out, at what point did you decide that this large, imposing, sometimes arrogant man was going to be your soulmate?
It took a very long time, Joan. But somehow, part of it was I had a boyfriend named Mr. I'm not going to give his whole name, but Swanson was his last name. And my friends used to always call him Swan Song because we were always breaking up.
Right.
And we went to Peter's house one time because he was doing these film strips of children and other children in the city for the Holt Urban series. And Bob and I went to his house, and when we left, Bob was very annoyed. And I said, what's the matter? He said, I want to know why you're not with me like you are with that Peter Buckley. And I thought, that's interesting. And I realized that I was completely myself around Peter. So it took a little while longer because, you know, he was 15 years older and he was...
He had kids.
He had three children, whom I adored, but nonetheless, he had three children. And And he was this larger-than-life person who sort of didn't – he would say anything and do anything. And I'm one of those people who always sort of wants to be sure everybody's happy and everybody likes me. And but all of a sudden, at some point, I just changed from being a good friend to being in love with him. And so we got married in 1963 and embarked on a life of fun and adventure.
And certainly fun to read. And even beginning with your wedding, because it no longer exists, but I used to go there all the time, Old Denmark.
Oh, it was wonderful.
It was wonderful. It was like a lot of other things. It was civilized
yes.
and friendly and delicious.
Exactly. Civilized, friendly, and delicious is a perfect description of a lot of places that that existed and that we loved.
So you marry Peter, and you go on a very entertaining kind of honeymoon.
Right. And Peter wouldn't call it a honeymoon. You know, he called it the wedding special because he thought honeymoon was way too
prosaic
and plebeian. You know, it was the wedding special. So it had two parts. And never again did we travel so extravagantly. But it was very exciting to do once.
And to go to Marrakesh and all those wonderful places and eat food. Your guide, a kid, took you home to his mother's for dinner. And what Susan, who grew up to be a writer, a lot of children's books, and an editor, this is her first non-children's book.
Yes.
And it was really quite amazing. There are recipes throughout the book, too, sharing your great gastronomic adventures.
Well, Peter was a fantastic cook, and he wasn't a fancy cook in the sense of not making very difficult, you know, soufflés and millefeuille and all kinds of things like that. But he was a wonderful flavorer, and he's also fantastic at I wanted us to do a book called Ready Ahead, because he had a fantastic ability to get everything ready ahead of time so that he didn't have to sort of cook it and put it on the table
he
at the last minute.
There.
He was there, and he had a great sense of timing, and he had me. So I became the person who would sort of get it all together at the end. But he, at one point, the reason why I have some of these recipes is because at one point I got tired of it. I'd say, Peter, make that chicken that you made last week. And he'd say, I can't remember how to make it. So I have this little black book
where you kept
that I wrote down the recipes, and they're very amusingly stated. You know, and he says, add some of this and put in that and then cook it. But so I had to turn those recipes into real
They had to work.
Know, recipes. So I had a cast of not thousands, but a cast of about 10 people who were good friends who helped me by doing the recipe testing.
When you go on these travels with Susan and Peter, their dogs came along with them. Think of what a time it was. And Peter would bring back enough food to stock five houses, and you paid $50 overweight. That
yeah.
was it.
Yeah, that was the most extreme, and it was very funny. I mean, the key with Peter was that I found so many of these outrageous things very funny, because he was very sweet in a crazy way. I mean, he had this big booming voice, and he was sort of larger than life, literally and figuratively. But he was also very funny, and I thought it was funny. And so, you know, faced with this 450 pounds of luggage, this one ridiculous time. One could have just been horrified. But instead,
right.
It was really funny to realize what we had done. We had this station wagon in France, and one year when it was like 84 or something, and it was 10 francs to the dollar. And we had the station wagon, just the two of us, and we were running around France for a month. And we went to all the great places.
Everything.
We just kept putting it in the back of the station wagon. And most of it wasn't huge. It would be like soap or material. Then we had these 4 gallons of olive oil that was heavy. But, you know, it was just in all the pâtés and this. But none of it was individually huge and extravagant. But it was ridiculously extravagant to have just bought all of it. And then we had to get it back. And somehow we did. But I realized when I was telling this story to some good friends one time, and I could see they were just horrified at the idea that we would have had this much stuff. And it set me to thinking, and it was something that was good that I actually added to the book, was it made me think about the fact that what Peter really, he used to say his passport was American, but his soul was French.
He was brought up in France.
He was brought up in France and Europe overall, but France particularly. And he was bilingual in French and English. And he really, I think he would bring these things home, and we'd bring all of our plates, you know, we brought back from Italy
Everything.
Or France, and they were all kind of what I call story things. And it was a way for Peter, I think, of bringing France home with him. Much more than it was. It wasn't greedy. It was
touching a life that he had had.
Exactly.
And you describe his children, I mean, with a father who every weekend took them to museums, who took them to fabulous restaurants, to Europe, where nothing fazed them. Did they grow up to be like their dad, foodies?
Oh, yeah, they're very good cooks, and they are very adventurous and very, very civilized.
Uh-huh.
Very wonderful.
Well, then when you grow up like that, you know, that's a different story. And I love the places that you stayed in where the innkeepers and the chefs, many of the Michelin chefs, became part of your extended family.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is a lot of these things, you know, might not happen today, but the salient characteristic of all of this is was the people more than the food. And Peter had this insatiable curiosity, which was very affecting and infectious, because he really wanted to make friends with – he liked all these people, and we made friends with them. And that's something that even though a lot of these places and stores and et cetera don't exist anymore – you can, by making friends, I think, curiosity and make friends, be curious and make friends, will give you adventures no matter what.
Exactly. And your own coming of age, Susan, when this was not your world and it became your world.
I grew up, I was very prepped for it because I grew up in Louisiana, in Southwest Louisiana, where food is very
important.
Food is really important. And in my childhood, it wasn't as, you know, sort of Cajun cooking is now a thing. But then it was just the way everybody ate. But the idea of what you were going to eat for dinner and what Lou, my grandparents' wonderful cook, was going to make, and it all became something that kind of prepped me
for
life with Peter, and for a world in which eating with Peter was going to be really fun.
Right, and spending a day poring over menus to decide what you're going to eat for dinner.
Right.
And enormous meals, multi-courses, gorgeous wine. You were ready to go for the next.
Totally.
Are you still involved in food in many ways? Are you giving these fabulous dinners that you and your husband had?
Well, I do give have a lot of company for dinner as opposed to dinner parties.
Uh-huh.
Because we were just so used to, you know, where there were already sometimes often, you know, four or five of us. And so adding a couple more people
meant
just
nothing.
Yeah, it was just the sort of regular life.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I say at the end of Eating with Peter, that at first I thought, oh, I can't do this. You know, this is going to – it's all over. And then I realized that having friends for dinner was such a really important part of my life that I would just go ahead and do it. And so I did.
And
I cook, yes. And one of the things that I learned from Peter was really how to construct a meal, you know, how to do it ready ahead so that it wasn't overwhelming.
You weren't in the kitchen.
I wasn't in the kitchen all the time. So I learned a lot of good lessons because all those years, you know, 25 years of being married to Peter, I didn't cook. I made dessert.
You had to eat. You
right.
didn't have time to
exactly.
cook.
Exactly. I mean, for years, I never ate lunch, essentially, because I knew I was going to have this fabulous dinner every night.
With these incredible dessert, nothing was left out. You needed balsamic vinegar, which in those days you couldn't get here.
Right.
You would travel halfway around the world to find a bottle. Eating with Peter, a gastronomic journey. It's wonderful travel, wonderful food, and great adventures of a gentler time when you could go anywhere in quest, in search of the perfect whatever it might be. Congratulations, Susan.
Well, and thank you so much for having me.
No, I really love reading it. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
And welcome, everyone, to the Joan Hamburg Show. And what's more fun than traveling, or if you can't travel, traveling vicariously through someone else. John Higgins, the Globetrotter, and you may know him because he's producer and host of Globetrotter TV, a lifestyle travel show. A lot of fun, a lot of food. He's got his latest book, The Globetrotter, where he literally takes you all over the world enjoying his adventures. And I first met John, 25 years ago,
longer.
30 years ago, you were doing fashion and you were dressing all the stars. I remember fabulous clothes.
Absolutely.
So how did we get from fashion and you were doing great into seeing the world?
Well, I've always traveled, even as a kid. When I lived with my granddad, we traveled all over Florida because that's where I'm from.
Is that where, which town, where did you grow up?
Sanford.
Uh-huh.
The last stop on the auto train. Nobody
right.
knows what I'm talking about when I say that. But it's a small town. I went back several years ago and I thought, thank God I left this town.
It's so funny. But what made you leave? When you grow up like that, you're like you or get out or you want to stay forever.
Actually, my mother was living in New York. So I wrote her a letter and I said, I want to come and spend some time with you. So what happened was she came down that summer right after, what was it, the fourth grade, and picked me up and my sister, and we came to New York, and it was a real cultural shock.
And you guys moved in with your mom, who you had not lived with in a while.
Exactly. And so that was a whole new experience.
Uh-huh.
And then traveling has always been in my blood since I was a kid, but my first international trip was to Rio. For Carnival. Can you imagine at 22?
How exciting. Oh. And someone who loved flair and clothes and food.
It's all there. And, you know, it was a language I'd never heard before. The people were so beautiful and simpatico, and it was just such a great experience. I really loved it.
So you started doing clothes.
Yes.
And started getting really major clients.
Absolutely. And editorials in all the magazines like Vogue and Harper's and Look and the New York Times and Women's Wear and so forth and so on. And so it was just an incredible thing. Actually, the Schoenberg Library has a whole collection.
Of your things.
Yeah, absolutely. Of the editorials. And it's like 12 boxes, which is amazing.
Mm. So, John, what made you... You never walked away from it, but you sort of gently switched it more to the travel thing.
Absolutely.
So why and how?
Well, actually, I was on a trip. I was producing a show in Japan, mm-hmm. and then I came back, and I was in Ghana, and one of the airlines said to me, maybe you can get together 12 people. I said, how do I do that? So I spoke to Hal Jackson, who was on another station, and he said, let's do it together. So before we knew it, I had 450 calls. People were very interested. We got 96 people on the first trip, so I was really excited. I said, now I'm in another business. And then from that, I started writing. And then people said, gee, you know, can you write for me? Can you write for me? And so therefore, I started writing. And I just continued. And I, you know, the show came
up. And you write.
And so it was just, you know, an evolution, you know, evolved. I evolved into what I'm doing now. And I love it.
And when John takes you places, whether he takes you to Malaysia or Vietnam or any place in Italy, he'll share a favorite taste, a recipe, like gelato.
Oh, or love gelato.
Who doesn't love gelato? Or spring rolls.
Excellent.
From Vietnam, and you can get them two ways. Fried, which, of course, fried paper, and it's delicious.
Oh,
or the cold ones, which I love. Vietnam was one of my favorite trips.
An amazing destination.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing.
And the people are so friendly there. And the food is so good.
The food, well, Asia, it's hard to go wrong.
Absolutely.
No matter where you eat, right?
Absolutely.
I've never been to Malaysia, but you made me want to go.
You have to go. It's incredible. I mean, I've had a number of experiences there that I have absolutely loved and cherished.
So how do you pick your destinations as the globetrotter?
Well, I look at the map and I say, where haven't I been? Where would I like to go back to? And when I go back, it's another experience. I'll give you an example. Indonesia, which I've been to 9 times. Mm. I said to them, you know, let's see, we've done the rocks, we've done the beaches, we've done the historical things, we've done the islands. What do the young people do here? So we had an experience of going where the young people go and experience that. So we always look for another experience. They have a date museum there, which features 250 different kinds of dates. Can you imagine? And that's in Tuzur. It's fabulous. And there's just all these different experiences. Anyway, I sort of make a list in the beginning of the year and I say, these are the places I
want
to go. And then if I don't accomplish that, I put them on next year's list and, you know, just keep working until I get them done. And that's how I do it.
So how long do you go for at a time?
It all depends. I mean, for instance, I did the Yucatan for 16 days. I was sick of Mexican food after 16 days.
You can. You have to be Mexico. Even today, you have to be very careful.
Well, you know, I said to somebody once that I could eat roadkill. Nothing bothers me.
But a little lettuce in Mexico can wipe you out.
It depends. Actually, they have a new thing that they started, I think, in 2000, where all of the hotels have to filter and the restaurants have to filter their water. So it's pretty safe. I drink from the tap, so it's actually
fine. Oh, no. I would never do that in Mexico.
I've done
You're
it.
Brave.
Well, you know, as I said, I could eat roadkill.
I know. But knock on wood, please, because we don't want that to change. But you went to a lot of places in Mexico that, like, I never heard of it. Not just the obvious. You found little villages that...
Oh, well, you're my favorite for a holiday is Holbox. I always talk about Holbox.
I never even heard of that until I read it in your book.
It's fabulous. Holbox. And it's a special island right off the Yucatan. And it's dirt roads, beautiful little town. And Casa Sandra is a perfect place to stay. And you look out of your window or these huge windows and you have these swaying palm trees and the beach. What could be better than that?
Now, was it reasonable?
It's... You know, it depends.
In between.
Yeah, it's in between. But it's a place that you'll never forget. And I've been there twice, and I can't wait to go back.
Mm. So what else is on your wish list for the next John Hagen's trip?
Well, I'd love to do China, which I haven't done. I'm sure you've done China.
We've done China a couple of times. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. And then, of course, the South Pacific, which I've done, Tahiti mm-hmm. and Fiji. But there's so many other islands that I'd love to go and see. There's so many places in the world, and I don't think you can do it all at one time, you know, in a lifetime.
No, and you want to take it with short spurts so
Absolutely.
You can appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You know what was fascinating, too? Mauritius, which I think is fantastic. Have you been there?
I have never been there.
Oh, my God. It's just an amazing destination. They have a place there at Seven Colors of Sand, and they talk about falling in love seven times, you know, because of the sand. It's just an amazing destination and great resorts there. My first editorial in Vogue was photographed in Mauritius, the island, with Marissa Berenson. So I always wanted to go there, and I went, and I've been there twice. I'd love it.
And you love it.
Absolutely.
One of your favorites.
Absolutely.
And you still love, like, Italy, which you've been to so many times.
I've been to, I guess, six regions of Italy, which has 20 regions. I have more to do. You know, there's more work to be done. And I can't wait to go back. I'm so excited. I'm going to the south of France. That's going to be the next trip, and Ireland. So that's a great experience.
Ireland is great. We rented a house right on the Cliffs of Moher, right there.
Oh, my God.
John, spectacular.
Unbelievable.
And it's a whole area filled with music and wonderful food. Ireland is divine.
Oh, and the green pastures. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
Yeah.
And wonderful hiking and walking. One of my kids is in Peru right now. Have you done that?
I have been to Peru, and I was on the Amazon in Peru, which I thought was fantastic.
Wow.
And we went to visit the villages, you know, and we did all kinds of things.
All along the way.
And also I can't remember what it's called, where everything is carved into the mountains. That was a whole other experience. So we've done a bit of Peru, including Lima, of course, and it's just been an incredible experience. Just, you know, I'm blessed, I think, in the sense that I've had a chance to see so much of the world and so many cultures and people that I've met around the world, which I love.
So now you have friends everywhere you go.
Absolutely.
And John's book is The Globetrotter, which is part of what he does. He has his TV series. And every destination tells you all the things that you can do. Plus, he shares food and recipes. Now, I never knew you were a cook, too.
Oh, I'm not a cook. But what I love about the book is that all the pages are filled with photographs. So as you're reading, you're traveling with me.
And you're getting hungry.
Absolutely. I get hungry anytime anybody mentions food, and I'm a foodie. I love food and lots of different kinds of food.
Oh, of course. Well, you don't want to do China in the summer because it's really hot.
Oh, yes.
In August. But you would love that destination.
I'm sure. You know, and there's so many other places that I still want to do. I'd love to do Korea, which I haven't done. I've done Cambodia. I've done Malaysia, Thailand, but I still want to do, and Vietnam. I still want to do more of the Asian countries. I've done Japan as well.
They're great. You know, we used to do listener trips all the time, and Korea has fabulous shopping.
Oh.
South Korea, of course.
Yes.
Fabulous shopping. And I remember one of the listeners was all excited. I found all the Polo t-shirts,
oh.
she said, for nothing, for $4.
Oh.
So I, of course, run. I didn't even look. I said, I'll take plank, 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 plank. I piled my suitcase. And when I got home, I said to one of my kids, look what I got you, these gorgeous Polo t-shirts. She said, Mom, have you looked at the horse? I said, no. It only had three legs. It was my bargain. And you're not doing clothes at all anymore?
I haven't done that in 35 years.
I know. Did your sister ever grow up to have your wanderlust?
No, unfortunately.
She didn't want to do anything
that. No, no. But you know what? I'm delighted that I had a chance to do it. And
you have the courage to do it.
And I moved on. And
did your mother encourage you as a child, or it was you?
It was really me.
Something inside.
Yeah. I was always curious about, I remember going to the high school, and I was taking an illustration class, and I said, I want to know more about the garment. So then mm-hmm. I transferred to the High School of Fashion, had 2 years there, and then I went on to FIT. And when I came out, I really blossomed in FIT. It was just an incredible experience there.
Because you felt at home.
I did, as a matter of fact. And then for about 2 years, I sort of stumbled with a number of jobs, which I hated anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started my own thing, which I was very happy. Sybil Burton was one of the people who was very supportive when she had
Arthur's.
She was
special.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Arthur's was one of the early great clubs
absolutely.
In New York. She had been married to Richard Burton, Kate Burton, her amazing actress daughter.
Right. And she just divorced him, and she opened the club.
And
everybody was there.
Survived well.
Absolutely. I ran into her several years later. She said, I felt like such a star. I said, you are a star, my dear. You know, she's just wonderful.
Star.
Yeah.
She was great.
So after going there many, many nights, I had created a collection, and I called Randy Marcel over at Glamour, and she says, no, you belong at Vogue. So I called Vogue. Vogue saw me right away, and that was the beginning of all of that.
Yeah, very exciting.
Absolutely.
And now, on to the next. John Higgins, the Globetrotter. The book is everywhere, I take it.
And on Amazon as well.
Perfect. And it's not only, we talked about Asia, but it's places that you have never gone to, as well as places that you know you can go to. So very good. Good job. Wonderful illustrations. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome, everyone, to the Joan Hamburg Show. And if you have been lucky enough in a European travel, a little trip, to go to Monet's Gardens, especially in the last, I'd say, decade or 5 years, it's spectacular and such a wonderful trip, even if you were just planning to stay in Paris. Easy to get to. So now, a gorgeous new book, and it's a perfect size, too. Everyday Monet by Aileen Boardman, who wrote Monet's Palette Cookbook. But I love to garden. And when you see something like the Monet Gardens, you only want to know, I want my gardens to look like that. So here in this lovely book, you've got gardening, you've got lifestyle, you've got recipes, and you've got inside information about Monet. You know, we look at beautiful pictures and Monet, but he was a real person with a real life, had his adventures, his disappointments, his successes, and leaves not only gorgeous artwork, but gardens that are, again, a living testament to what he does. But Aileen Boardman, you've done a lot of different things in your life. You've produced, you've written, you are the head of Monet's Palette. That's a company that deals with everything with Monet. But how did this come about? I know your mother was one of the people who really made these gardens something to go, oh my gosh, I can't believe it.
Exactly. Well, first, I want to thank you so much for welcoming me to your home here and bringing Everyday Monet, Claude Monet, the aesthetic to your listeners. It means a lot. My mother is the American representative at Monet's Gardens in Giverny. This year marks her 38th year.
But how did your mother even 38 years ago, become involved with this. She wasn't living in the middle of New York City top of the Metropolitan Museum. What happened?
That's a really great question, Joan. She got bitten by the same Monet bug that bit me. She went to the wonderful exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1978. And just was taken by these paintings, and then heard subsequently, very close to that time, heard that they were going to be bringing Monet's gardens back to life. What a lot of people don't know is that when Monet passed, the gardens fell into complete ruin.
Right.
They didn't exist. And so she made contact with the curator at the time, Moffat, who did the exhibit, who then introduced her to Lila Atchison Wallace, the great reader. Reader's Digest. In fact, Joan, just so you know, every time we enter the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there's those beautiful flowers. That's because of Lila.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
She endowed. And so she endowed Monet's gardens, the people that were putting this together, trying to restore the gardens with $1 million, which in around circa 1978 was a hell of a lot of money. I like to call it seed money in this case. And that started the whole ball rolling. And my mother was referred to the Vanderkamps. In fact, Gerald Vanderkamp, who actually hid the Mona Lisa, ready for this, under his bed during the war so that the Nazis couldn't take it. He and his wife did the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. And once they had completed that, what do you do next? And Mr. Vanderkamp, lovely man, decided to bring Monet's magical world, the beauty and the aesthetic.
Back to life. But your mom, it was more than just, these are beautiful. She really became involved. Was she working when you guys were little?
She really wasn't working. She really was a stay-at-home mother. My father was a professor. During the summers, as a family, we would travel. I had the benefit and was blessed to be able to travel to Europe early in life and to France.
So I fell in love.
I was a Francophile before I even knew it. And certainly there's got to be something genetic. They say that there's things that sometimes if you like pizza,
It's in the blood,
you know, and there's pizza in my blood. But also there seems to be something about Monet that's in the blood.
Well, as a child, a
genetic predisposition.
Aside from because, you know, with kids, it's beautiful, but you became really passionate about it?
Yes.
Yeah, so and when did you start working on it?
So much when you say passionate, so much so. I was sitting at Monet's dining room table.
At his home,
and saw the beauty through the window. I smelled the perfume of the flowers in the air. No, I was pinching myself. I thought, I'm so blessed. How do I bring this to the world? How do I spread the joy that I'm experiencing? The crazy thing is, Joan, at the time, and up until 3 weeks ago, I was a financial advisor. I was on Wall Street working. My specialty was municipal bonds, of all things.
Well, it's okay.
And I used to kid with people. I could get as creative as deciding if I did a pie chart for people's investments, whether I could use fuchsia for bonds versus, you know, green or, you know, the traditional colors.
So what made you give that up and do this?
Well, I didn't give it up completely. Mm-hmm. I transitioned. It was like one person, two careers. And every time I did something, I kept realizing I had to do this more and more. It just fed my soul, not only to do the work, to do the making of a film and writing the book and discovering that I had an ability to take photographs, which I discovered through this process, the idea of not doing this full-time became impossible. I was now dedicated to sharing. I'm on a mission of stewardship really. My mother, I say that, you know, people carry a baton or get passed a baton. I've had the benefit of having this baton with my mother. We carry the baton together.
Right. And it's even more about the gardens. It's the kind of style that Monet had in his home, the use of copper, the pots in the kitchen,
exactly.
His bedroom, which was really like an art studio.
Yes. And in Everyday Monet, just to, you know, explain, you know, the whole genesis of this book and the reason why this is so important is that if you want to have the beauty that Monet experienced, the gardens, as you just mentioned, the copper, his love of gingham and lace and the beauty that he created, it's not so difficult. People may think and become overwhelmed. And
right.
What I've done in this book is not only give you a foundation, a history of Monet, the beauty of Normandy. I always say there was a year in Provence and under the Tuscan sun, here comes Monet and Normandy, you know?
Right, which is very special. And even if you have a little space, I like that you told people how to take big-time ideas and turn them into possibilities for small spaces.
Absolutely. This book is all about accessibility. It's what Impressionism is all about.
Right. One of the-
and, you know, if you take, I have a chapter, as you know, in the book called Water Lily Can Grow in
right.
Brooklyn, too.
Right.
A little nod to the old book and film. And, you know, the whole idea that you can just be transported to the magic and the colors and the perfume and the whole aesthetic and beauty of Giverny by having one singular, exquisite water lily in a very simple vessel that you could place on a porch, on a terrace in New York,
right.
On a rooftop, in your backyard.
And make it special. And this great artist loved to eat. He loved his picnics. Tell me about the recipes.
Well, you know,
are you a cook?
I'm a cook. I'm not a trained cook. I'm not a professional cook. But I have discovered that I have a finesse for recipe development. And I did all the recipes in my former book and knew that if I was doing Everyday Monet, here we have, I'm telling you what colors to put on the walls, how to bring the flower arrangements to the table and into your home, how to do all these special things that Monet did as an entertainer as well. How could I leave you high and dry and not explain how to
exactly.
do the perfect picnic or the perfect luncheon? There are a few very, very special recipes that I created, tied to, again, Monet's love of simple, fresh cuisine, seasonal, like we like to eat
right,
now.
Right, perfect.
Monet would go every day into his kitchen garden with his chef Marguerite and choose whatever was fresh that day to decide what he'd put on the menu. And, you know, this is what we're trying to do today, right?
That's right, except I loved your apple cider donuts.
Thank you so much.
That's
a nod to Monet's love of cider, Monet's love of Normandy and the apples, right?
Right, the apples with the orange caramel.
Exactly. So it's
good recipes.
There's one recipe in particular that is the steak sandwich.
You know, I have a friend who always makes for company, and I'm always like, steak sandwiches, that's a weird thing to serve, but if Monet did it, we can do it.
Yeah, and the idea is that I also say this is a roadmap. If you're vegan, use mushrooms, use beautiful
right,
portobello
whatever.
Mushrooms. And I developed a sauce that is a combination of wasabi and honey.
No, it
because
sounded so
Monet
good.
Loved everything Japanese, which I will explain in this book and teach you how to integrate some of the beauty, the Japanese bridges that he had and the Japanese woodcut prints that he collected. And so I took the little twist of the honey and the wasabi mustard, and it was like just this little nod.
Well, it sounds good. I'm sure everyone will want to eat at your house.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
Aileen Boardman, in a beautiful new book, I like that it's the right size. You know, you can have it as a coffee table book, but you can actually have it hands-on
yes.
whenever you want
yes,
it's cold.
Yes, it could be in the kitchen.
Anywhere.
But I would say that if you take off the cover, and people will see when they buy the book, there's this beautiful embossed water lily.
I love it.
And the purple, as you see, it's so exquisite.
It's wonderfully done.
It's a gift and it's evergreen. It's the kind of book that I'm hoping, just as a legacy and a stewardship with respect to Monet, that it's the kind of book that you'll pass down and keep in your family.
Why not? Aileen Boardman, Everyday Monet. And it's gardening, it's lifestyle, it's food. Thank you all for sharing. We'll take a quick break. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.